Good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have one case that's set for oral argument and a few others that are going to be submitted without argument later this afternoon. Before we begin, I want to introduce our panel members today. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and to my left is Justice Elizabeth Kerr, and I'm Justice Bonnie Sutterth. If everyone's ready, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Thank you so much for your time today here, Chief Justice Sutterth, Justice Kerr, Justice Gabriel. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you. I also wanted to thank the court for giving me an extension on my oral argument. As some of you may know, I was overseas on active duty, serving in the Air Force in a JAG capacity, and y'all actually put off, not an extension of time, but a reset for resetting oral argument. I believe it was previously set a few months ago, and then y'all reset it for today, and I appreciate that. Brian Smith will be coming up and doing the rebuttal. As the clerk mentioned, he's an attorney with Whitaker Chalk, and I represent Donald Wells together with Mr. Smith, and of course I'm in private practice. I don't want to obviously waive any of the issues in my appellant's brief that was previously submitted with the court, but I'm going to reserve my argument, all of my argument, for the first issue in appellant's brief, which is this important issue I believe that the court's probably entertaining oral argument on, and that is whether or not SANE nurse findings, their reports, are subject to Crawford and are testimonial under a Crawford analysis, and therefore subject to the Confrontation Clause of the United States Constitution. I have an interesting perspective on this case because I was the trial lawyer in this case, and so I know a little bit about, obviously, the facts all the way back to the beginning. As it's pointed out in my brief, prior to trial, the state filed a Brady notice that the sexual assault nurse examiner, the SANE examiner in the case, had been known to have lied on some reports in the past, and so they put me on notice through Brady of that effect. And then at trial, instead of calling SANE nurse examiner Dismaris, they instead called her supervisor, a doctor who had no factual knowledge of the sexual assault nurse examination. Instead, obviously, I lodged objections for under confrontation clause, and also lodged some hearsay objections. And of course, the unique set of facts in this case is a little bit different than the few cases that are in this area of jurisprudence. Is the fact that the declarant was the SANE nurse examiner herself. In the past, there were some cases that talked about if you have an alleged victim or a lot of times in family violence cases, in those contexts, where the victim would decide not to show up for court, and then they would try to get that testimony in through alternative means, including SANE nurse examiners. This case, you have a sexual assault nurse examiner writing down what the alleged victim has told her at the time. It's important to mention just right now that this is 4 years. This is one of these delayed outcry cases where it was 4 years after the alleged assault took place.
Go ahead.
Would you characterize it really as a delayed outcry, or I mean, because the alleged victim talked about it before, it's just that the adults in her life didn't do anything about it, right?
Yes, ma'am. I mean, you might still characterize it. I don't. Because I believe even the first adult she spoke with was somewhat delayed, if I believe, from the factual scenario. I don't think it was something that happened within a few days. I think that the first individual that she actually talked to about this was sometime after the fact. And then obviously the one, I guess, the report that was made that led to law enforcement really getting involved was almost 4 years after it allegedly took place.
You rely on the Crawford reasonable expectation test for your analysis of this, but if that standard was abandoned and now the standard is the primary purpose test,
right?
Does your analysis, is it still testimonial in nature?
It is not testimonial under the primary purpose test.
That's under the primary purpose test. It's, yes. It's you're still arguing that it's not testimonial in nature.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. And in fact, that's I'm glad you asked that question because that's kind of where I'm going with this and talking about primary purpose because I do believe that is the appropriate
test. So you think it was abandoned? The reasonable expectation test has now been abandoned, you think?
I don't necessarily want to say that it was all out abandoned, but I definitely want to say that the primary purpose test is what I believe is the appropriate test.
That's what is applied
yes,
now.
Yes, Your Honor. And of course, the primary purpose test that was actually delineated in Michigan v. Bryant.
And I want to go back to your assertion that the declarant is actually the nurse. Isn't it the substance of what the declarant, what isn't it the substance of what the child said, the part that become is relevant and would be admissible because it's relevant, and therefore isn't it the child's statement that we're focusing on, and thus isn't the child a declarant, even though it goes through two. I get that it's going through two people to get
sure.
there, but is it? How do you say that yes. the sane is the declarant? I'm trying to figure that out.
Because she's actually writing it down based
right,
on whatever.
That's true in any medical record.
Sure.
The doctor writes it down. The nurse writes it down. But the declarant is the person who uttered the words allegedly.
Sure. Sure. Correct. And if I may on that point. One, I do think that it's the most, I guess, the probative, which is the crux of our concern, is the part where the alleged victim talked to the same nurse examiner and said these things allegedly, and she transcribed these things. I think that, and yes, maybe in medical records that's typically the case, but oftentimes even in police reports, for example, police officers will take a statement from an individual and they'll actually give them the opportunity to handwrite it themselves. That is definitely not the case in this instance. This is a situation where the doctor even admitted that, yes, this is St. Nurse Dismaris' notes. She wrote this down based on what we believe this alleged victim talked to, which is a big concern. It's a big concern because I did not have an opportunity to cross-examine her on the demeanor of the alleged victim, whether or not she seemed to be telling the truth. And obviously, I wasn't able to cross-examine her on, if we know you've lied in reports in the past, how do we know you're not lying in this report? How do we know that this is true? So those two.
You think that would have been admissible? You think a judge would have let that in?
I think there's a possibility. But the great thing about that question, Your Honor, is it really doesn't matter under Crawford analysis because we don't. There's case law out there that says, and the U.S. Supreme Court case law that says, that we don't necessarily have to look at what would have come out had I had the opportunity. You can take it in consideration, but it's not dispositive of whether or not there's a Crawford violation and whether or not I should have been able to cross-examine that individual.
But you did have the opportunity to cross-examine the child. And Crawford says if you have the opportunity to cross-examine the child, then it doesn't apply.
That's correct. But I do not believe that
And the only way you get around that is by saying that the nurse was the declarant.
Absolutely. And I believe
I'm still having a problem with that.
Sure.
What is it that the nurse wrote that made the nurse the declarant?
Well, she's writing down a resuscitation of facts that are related to her in the way that we believe to be true. I mean, everything that a declarant ever says, in my opinion, for the most part, is something that they didn't necessarily get from firsthand knowledge. It's things that they've observed. It's things they've seen. I mean, that would be the case outside of the justice system. That would be the case for even fiction, I would say.
So the saint's observations make – you're saying that the saint had observations independent of what the child was saying, and those observations then would make – the saying the declarant?
Not necessarily. I think the virtue of her actually being the one to transcribe
Scribe.
It makes her the declarant. I think it is a statement that she made, and therefore that's where it becomes problematic for purposes of Crawford. I don't think that's totally novel in that there's a case that's not very helpful to us that wasn't published that came out of Tyler earlier in this year where they look at this situation where they're saying, okay, well, it's true that you have a situation where we're looking at a sane nurse examiner's report and we have a different sane nurse examiner testifying to the contents of that report. And, you know, we'll agree that this is probably a declarant, but we're going to say it wasn't testimonial because it was for medical purposes. That's what they, the conclusion that they reached in that case, and obviously I think it was wrongly decided because...
Even this court has a history in Morrison and Beheller to finding that these are non-testimonial statements if they're pursuant to a sane exam, correct? So you want us to reverse our position on this?
No, Your Honor, I don't think those are good law anymore because they're pre-Crawford. Beller was decided in 1999, and Crawford was decided in 2004. And
2007.
And
it was 2007.
Beheller.
Morrison.
Oh, Morrison. Well, the Beheller was, I believe, 1999, and it really was addressing the issue of hearsay, which obviously, as you,
the medical exception.
Right, to hearsay, correct, Your Honor. Obviously, which is different than a confrontation clause analysis.
You argue at trial that? Because of this concern that the saying has been untruthful or whatever in the past, that this hearsay, obviously this hearsay evidence, did not have an indicia of trustworthiness, reliability, such that it should be admissible under that theory? Was that argued or advanced to the trial court?
Your Honor, I objected under Crawford, a confrontation violation, and under hearsay. And so I addressed them both.
Well, were you arguing that a hearsay exception didn't apply, or were you saying that notwithstanding the hearsay exception, it still didn't have indicia of trustworthiness?
Well, what we got into is when I lodged my hearsay objection, the state said, well, an exception applies, and that's the medical records exception, which they're saying. I mean, that's the thing that happens a lot of times with Crawford is we get them kind of muddled. And obviously, you can have situations where something may be hearsay, but it's still not violative of the confrontation clause. And you might have situations where you have things that are violative of the confrontation clause, but they're absolutely not hearsay.
Sure.
And I think Justice Scalia kind of riddled his early case law jurisprudence with that, just saying, you know, this is apples and oranges. However, sometimes the lines are blurred. But they were arguing it was a medical record exception and a business record exception. That's why it wasn't hearsay. And then, of course, I was arguing that wasn't the case. And then when it came to confrontation clause, they were saying that it wasn't a confrontation violation because it was a medical record. That was kind of the split analysis that took place. I don't know if the words reliability came out of my mouth per se, but it was pretty implicit from what I was talking about that I was concerned about the hearsay problem and the confrontation problem.
Do you think that there is a time element that this court or another court needs to delve into? I mean, as I understand it, part of your argument is that because of the time that had elapsed when the sane nurse got involved, it really wasn't for medical treatment, but purely for prosecution purposes.
Absolutely.
So is there, I mean, what is the sliding scale? I mean, how much time needs to elapse before something falls out of being medical treatment?
Well, if I may, first, I think that even if a sane nurse examination is done an hour after the alleged assault, then you still have some confrontation problems. I think sane nurses' reports in general are confrontation violations because they are made for the purpose of evidence with a forethought. What happens with a lot of the cases, and some of these lower courts have confused, is it's clear from the case law, and the Supreme Court says it is an objective test, but then they'll say even this Tyler case that came out earlier this year, they'll say, they'll basically concede it's an objective test, but then they'll say, but we can't say that this was done for the primary purpose is law enforcement because it's a situation where the medical purposes kind of trump that. And by saying that, we would have to just basically ignore all the testimony from the witness who came in and testified these were done for medical purposes. Well, that makes it a subjective test.
That there's still a Crawford violation, even if it's an hour or a day later, but the case law says it's not a Crawford violation if you have the opportunity to cross-examine the declarant, which in those cases is the child, which you had the chance to do in this case.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, but I do not believe that the declarant is the child, Your Honor. I think in this situation, it's absolutely the same nurse examiner who did not come in. If I may, because it looks like did that fully answer your question. If I may, because I didn't get a lot of time to kind of go through some of these things that I was concerned about, two things. One, medical records, you have to look at the primary purpose regardless, if you believe it is a declarant, as Justice Gabriel's pointing out. Primary purpose, what was it for? And was it a statement made with a forethought for prosecution or the possibility that it might be used to prove some kind of element at trial? Then, once you get there, the medical records, well, it's the primary purpose. And saying that people go and see sane nurses when it's done at the behest of law enforcement for medical purposes, like I say in my brief, it's kind of like saying that they're going to the movies for the popcorn. That's not the primary purpose. And if police officers didn't tell them to do it, people wouldn't go to sane nurses. These are very similar to the Bullworth instances. I believe once the U.S. Supreme Court gets a sane nurse case, which they haven't yet, I believe they're going to find that sane nurse examination reports are testimonial. Why? Because they're done at the behest of law enforcement. They're also not medical records because that's an ancillary purpose and for many other reasons. The last thing in closing that I'll say for my part is, if you really just think, though, if we take the legal analysis aside, the question we have to ask ourselves is, should a prosecutor who has a witness that they know have lied on a report in the past...
You keep saying that. Did they ever say in their Brady violation this person lied? Or did they say that disingenuous. There were inconsistent statements?
No, I believe they said that. It's pretty strong language, Your Honor. I don't know if the words lie actually are used verbatim, but it's very strong language. It's clear that they believe that same nurse Desmaris has been dishonest in a report before, and in fact she has made attempts to change the report to cover up her dishonesty that's in the Brady violation. So the question is, should we allow that to happen? Should we allow the prosecutors to get a third-party witness to come in and backdoor in the contents of a report when the person who wrote that report has lied on reports in the past or at least been disingenuous in the past? Should that be allowed? And I think that's why we have this Crawford jurisprudence, to protect and prevent situations just like this. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Would you add 2 minutes to Ms. Faulkner's time, please? Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'd like to start out just briefly, if I can. One moment. I apologize. I'd like to start off just addressing the issue about sane nurse Desmaris. The Brady violation did not say that she had ever lied in a report. And in fact, I think I pointed out in the state supplemental brief, I discussed some of that for the court, that the case, it was an unrelated case that she was involved in. It was an adult sexual assault case, and she had been retained as an expert for the defense and had signed an affidavit to be included in a grand jury packet, I believe. In that case, and she signed an affidavit that contained statements that she later believed needed to be changed or refined, you might say. I don't think my interpretation of that Brady notice is not that she lied in a report or anything that in any way would call into question her writing down the statements of the complainant in this case. I'd also like to address the argument that it's the sane nurse and not the child who's the declarant in this case. Of course, the state's position is that the child is the declarant of the statements contained in the sexual assault exam report. Merely writing down what another person says does not make the person of those transcribed statements the declarant. Here, Dr. Kaufman, the medical director of the care team who testified at the trial, disclosed only the complainant's statements. Appellant refers often to the matters disclosed as the same nurse's findings, but in actuality, what Dr. Kaufman testified to were the child's statements transcribed by the same. So the state would argue that the complainant is the declarant of the statements. It's the complainant's statements that were offered for the truth and to of the matter from those reports, and the child is the declarant. As for the four-year time elapse that occurred in this case, I think Justice Kerr pointed out that, you know, it was a two-year delay before the complainant ever told anyone what had happened to her in this case. She told her aunt, who was dating the appellant and who lived with the appellant. The aunt did not believe her. It was, you know, for 2 years this went on. It was finally 4 years later when statements were made to a school counselor that a report was made to the police. So we have the four-year delay when the adults in the complainant's life were not taking any action or doing anything to assist her. But here, I don't think this is the case. If there is a case in the future where that time elapse is relevant, I don't think that this is the case. We have clear and unequivocal testimony from Dr. Kaufman, who detailed all of the reasons why, you know, most outcries are delayed to some extent, why medical exams, sexual assault exams, are still for medical diagnosis and treatment-related purposes, even following a delay, especially when, she said, when there's skin-to-skin contact of the genital areas. And in this case, you know, it did turn out that the complainant was referred for psychological or counseling outside of and to continue after the examination because of testing and other things that were run. So, I mean, the mere delay, and especially based on the evidence and testimony that we have in this case, that delay does not defeat the medical treatment and purpose of the exam that was conducted here.
I want to go back to the Brady notice for a moment.
Okay.
Why was the same the subject of a Brady notice if her veracity wasn't, or his veracity, wasn't called into question? Why would it even be revealed under Brady notice if there wasn't some negative implication as to veracity, trustworthiness, reliability, or something like that? If it's merely that they gave an expert report at some point?
I think that the thing was that, and it may, you know, I wasn't at the trial, so I don't have that benefit of those decisions, but I mean, I would say that especially in today's climate, and always, the state is and ought to be very cautious and very, you know, err on the side of caution maybe in what it does disclose under Brady. So, you know, I would think that because Ms. DeMaris was involved in this case, that if the office has a Brady notice, that they would disclose it. If I'm recalling, the Brady notice, like I said, concerned an affidavit where, if I'm remembering correctly, certain
she said it's subject
conclusions
to
or opinions were made about what some, I can't remember the exact changes.
Just
that
I got
she
of
made.
It was that you're saying that it's because she said these opinions or these statements are subject to correction or revision.
Right, and so,
but that's not really, if that's all it was, does that fall under Brady? I mean, isn't every affiant under the obligation to correct it if there's an error or revise
right.
it if it needs to be revised?
And in this case, it was her actions as a defense, retained defense expert. It wasn't even any, you know, it wasn't a affidavit or anything for the state. But I would say, you know, it's my own belief that our office errs on the side of caution and maybe discloses things, you know, that we
aren't
believe
necessarily
ought to be
negative.
Disclosed under Brady to.
So the your office was just disclosing the fact that she'd been a defense witness at some point.
I don't know if that's all. I mean, I think based on, like I say, I was not at the trial. I had no part in creating the Brady notice, but I think just she had given an opinion, signed an affidavit, changed her mind, or revised that opinion. whether that falls under Brady, like I say, I would argue that because I don't even think that if she had testified, I don't even think that would have been relevant necessarily to.
Well, but a defendant would want the opportunity to cross-examine
right.
a sane nurse who had corrected an affidavit in the past, surely.
Exactly. And I think that is, like I say, I mean, the state, in the spirit of full disclosure on anything that we know about someone that, you know, we think that we should disclose, we might. But
she wasn't at trial to be cross-examined.
Right. And that goes then to the merits of this, and the state's position is that we didn't need to call her to testify because the hearsay and the confrontation are kind of intertwined here, because I agree that the primary purpose test, an objective test of that, is what applies here, and the cases. There are plentiful that these types of exams, of medical records can be business records. Those are generally considered non-testimonial and should be here. The statements, the examination, everything that was generated in this case was for the primary purpose of medical diagnosis and treatment, which has been held to be non-testimonial.
Well, is the appellant correct that this same nurse was the only independent corroboration of what the child testified to in terms of what happened and when?
The only independent corroboration for some things that she said.
I thought that the appellant's position was that the other witnesses said that the outcry was different in location, time, whatever happened.
They did. Some of them did, and some of them at trial were asked about differences. Their testimony at trial may have changed some, and they were cross-examined about the differences. And it's sad to say, but if I'm recalling correctly, sometimes they just did not clearly recall. They thought she said something about being at the stove, but they weren't sure. Maybe they were confused because earlier the complainant and the defendant had been cooking. I mean, there were different things, and the defense had a complete chance to cross-examine everyone about all of the inconsistencies, and did at trial. I think that to say that the sane is the only person who corroborated any portion, I set forth in the harm analysis of my case other corroborating, you know, evidence, which included the child. I'm really not sure. I apologize. I don't want to say that she is the only one, but yes, the testimony of the complainant and the contents of the sexual assault exam, as testified to by Dr. Kaufman, matched up much more closely than any other complete story or version given from anyone else. But a lot of the adults did testify that they didn't maybe remember certain things, they didn't have a good memory. Even the school counselor who reported this to the police and started finally the whole investigation didn't take notes, she didn't have a good memory of what she was told. The father did, I believe, testify that the complainant told him what happened, and some of the witnesses, I believe, testified that some of the things the complainant said were consistent with. There were a lot of different stories and a lot of memories about what the complainant said, so. I guess unless the court has any further questions, the state would pray that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, I'd like to address a couple of points that the state made in response and then clarify only a couple of items that Mr. Walker raised in his argument. Specifically addressing the issue of credibility of the nurse, the record indicates that a Brady notice was provided, and my recollection is that although I also don't remember the exact language from the record, the point was that there were credibility issues with the nurse, whether it was a result of an issue was made in a statement that needed to be walked back at a later time, or a disingenuous misrepresentation. Both of those things go to credibility, and I'm confused why a Brady notice would have been sent if there was not a problem. With respect to the question of corroboration of the victim's testimony, the record reflects that there were numerous numerous descriptions of this incident that the victim offered, and they all were variously different. Sometimes the actual actions were different. Sometimes she said, well, nothing untoward happened at all. And that her statements to other individuals were presented at trial. The same nurse report, though, was the only one that did corroborate the position that she took at trial. And that is something that makes her testimony and the same nurse testimony in this case unique. The intention to use it as corroboration, to say that this is merely cumulative of her own testimony, sort of bootstraps this, because it's used to add weight and probative value to what she's testified in court, and certainly she's available for cross-examination, was cross-examined. But using it as corroboration, absent the ability to cross-examine the corroborating witness and then saying, well, it's merely cumulative because it restates her own testimony, is a circular argument. If it's used to corroborate, it can't also be corroborated by the victim's statement. That issue also makes this case unique in the sense of the question of who's the declarant in this scenario. While, for example, we would never take the position that in a deposition, the court reporter taking the deposition is a declarant of the statements in that testimony. Certainly, the statements made by the witness are the testimony, and that witness is the declarant. Compare that to a situation with medical records where an examining physician is making dictation into a recording device of both statements that a victim or a patient is making, along with that physician's observations. In that situation, the declarant as to the statements made on the recording is the physician, even though they may sometimes be reiterating statements made by that patient. Statements that the patient makes, that patient is the declarant there. But if we're seeking to introduce a recording that a physician made during an examination, that physician should be available for a cross-examination.
Any case law to support that?
Well, Your Honor, specifically on those points, no. But the cases that deal with medical exams and with laboratory tests, they come down on both sides of this. There are cases where blood tests are, this is clearly for the purpose of just gathering evidence, and then the analyst that took this test needs to be available for cross-examination. In the Bull Cummings versus New Mexico case, for example, very similar to this, the state even proffered the testimony of another analyst from the facility that I think they had a directorial.
That was a blood test result for the purposes of using it at prosecution, not for medical diagnosis.
You're correct, Your Honor. And there are cases that also have held blood tests that are routine for medical diagnosis are for the primary purpose of medical care, even if they are ancillarily used for evidence in a proceeding. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Your case has been submitted.